Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. I'm Travis Shaddix. It's going to be a fun day today. It is March 19th, 2024. Good morning, Super TA, Connecticut Cubanican, Gray Fox, we're all here. Andrew Burris asks, good morning, who's going to be the 1,000th subscriber? Yeah, I think it's sitting at right at 999 or something around that right now. So we may be on live while it crosses 1,000. Richard Adams, that's a new name to me. I don't remember Richard Adams, but you'll say you'll be able to watch a little bit later. You'll want to come back and watch a little bit later. You're going to see two turfgrass nutritionists nerd out today. So it'll be a fun day. Today I have a guest. We've been going over potassium for, I don't know, 2-3 weeks. And as I try to do as many times as I can, I try to have the guests on to discuss their paper so I don't mess up their very good work. And today I have a guest that he has to have set the record for the most well-traveled turfgrass scientist, probably in the history of turfgrass science. My guest today is Dr. Micah Woods. Good morning, Micah. How are you?
Yeah, good morning. I'm doing well. I'm joining you from a hotel room in Japan.
You are, yeah. I can't imagine, I mean, go back 100 years. I can't imagine any turfgrass scientist traveling more than you have. So you are probably the most well-known international turf scientist certainly one I can think of, probably on top of the chart of anybody, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to rate oneself, but I think as far as being well-traveled, I'm pretty sure that what I've done over the last 20 years or so it's hard to beat.
How long does a passport last you before it runs out of places for the stamps?
The shortest one was 2 years.
Oh, that's not too bad.
But that's with like two or three sets of extra pages. So it's like a 130 page passport.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, Micah, we've been talking about potassium. I want to have you come on and talk about your paper. But if there's by any chance, no, someone doesn't know who you are, do you mind kind of giving us a once over on, you know, who you are and how you got to where you're at today?
Yeah, I'm from Oregon. I grew up in the Willamette Valley, where a lot of the grass seed is produced. And I got into golf course maintenance after high school, and I really enjoyed that. So I went to Oregon State University, got a bachelor's degree in turf and landscape management, horticulture. And I wanted to get some international work experience. So I went to China to be an assistant superintendent. And my boss left after 5 months, and I became a golf course superintendent at the age of 22 in Shanghai. And then I went to Japan and worked as a superintendent. And when I was 25, I went back to Cornell University, and I'd been really interested in turfgrass nutrition and in soil testing, because when I was a golf course superintendent, I wanted to make sure that the grass was as healthy as possible. And I thought that by manipulating or adjusting the amount of fertilizer I applied, that I could make the grass as healthy as possible. So I was very lucky to work with Frank Rossi at Cornell University, doing a project about soil testing and really looking at potassium specifically and looking at different soil test extraction methods. So I did that until from the age of 25 to 29. And right before I turned 30, I graduated, started the Asian Turfgrass Center in Thailand. And since 2006, I've been doing that. And now I'm also the owner of Pace Turf. So I do the Asian Turfgrass Center, which is turfgrass, you know, I develop turfgrass information and share it. And I'm the director and owner of the Pace Turf Information Service, which is also a service that provides turfgrass information. So that's the short of it. And you can find more information about me at both of those websites.
That reminds me. Yeah, I'll put in a link to all your information in the description of this video, the ATC YouTube and your blogs and all that stuff. I forgot to do that prior to starting, actually. I'm glad you reminded me. I'll do that, actually. Let me make a note of that. That's interesting, because I knew you had been a superintendent, but I wasn't sure how that came about. It was sort of just, I guess, serendipity that you were there, and then superintendent moved on, and then you were there to fill his shoes, I suppose. So I was curious how that worked out. Thank you for letting me know that.
Yeah, I'd done internships. I'd worked at golf courses in Oregon, and then I'd done internships in Arizona and in Mississippi and in Georgia. So I'd worked around different parts of the U.S., and I thought it would be really nice to see some of the world and get some international work experience and just have, you know, when you're a kid and you just want to see the world, I thought I could go do that with turf grass.
Yeah.
And then I thought I'd be better prepared for graduate school and better prepared really for a career after graduate school, whether that would be as a professor, as a USGA agronomist, working for a company or working for myself or whatever. If I was going to be I just thought it would be a really attractive resume to have a graduate degree plus work all around the U.S. on my resume plus international work experience.
And yeah, then, and you did that before you went back to grad school. So there's some value in that. I'm a little bit skittish when students go out and I'm afraid they might not come back, really good potential graduate students. But when they do come back in those situations, oftentimes they come back with a different perspective that can really add value to their graduate work.
I highly recommend that. And for me, I was really focused on that long-term plan of what I wanted to do. And I was always planning to go back to graduate school because I just realized that I wanted to learn as much as I could about this topic. If I was going to spend my career as a, you know, working in the turfgrass industry, I wanted to take the opportunity if I could get it, if I could get accepted to graduate school, mm-hmm. And if I could do that and succeed and get through graduate school, I wanted to do that because I wanted to learn as much as I could.
Yeah. Yeah. Very well done. It's, you know, it's a good path to get to where you're at today. Well, and where you're at today is with me talking about potassium. We've been talking about potassium for a little while, and I wanted to bring up this little scoreboard about the various papers that I've gone over with the audience. And one reason I'm doing this and with you here today is to impress upon the audience that the concept that applied potassium is going to alleviate stress. There is some evidence in the literature for that, and I'll eventually get to that. But generally speaking, that tends to fall in the minority of cases relative to the majority of cases. And the majority of cases, at least on quote unquote normal soils, there's not a whole lot that happens to it when you fall to turf grass when you're following the application of applied potassium. And so I wanted to kind of use this, although these columns aren't weighted, they're just, you know, an article that showed some positive response, even though that positive response might have only been 20% of the time, and the no response might have been 80% of the time. I just wanted to make sure that the audience understands that from a scientific perspective, this is not particularly anything controversial in the scientific community, that applied potassium doesn't generally result in a whole lot of benefits to the turf usually. But it seems like from the layman's perspective or the general practitioner's perspective, they have this perception that it's going to, you know, change the world and reduce all this stress in the turf grass. And we see, well, how many we got here? We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 papers. And today's going to be the 8th paper. 7 papers that show, and they concluded in their paper somewhere, that nothing happened following the application of potassium. Of those 7, 6 concluded there was a negative response, some sort of harmful response to the turf, whether it was increase in disease or some other metric that they concluded. And we had 3 that resulted so far in a positive response, and all 3 of these happened to be coincidentally on yield. And then today, your paper is going to come down here where you have a variety of different initial soil K from different extractants. You use creeping bank grass, and we're going to fill in where your study lands in either positive, none, or negative. So I wanted to kind of, I go over this each potassium episode to make sure everybody understands. This is very common in the scientific community to see nothing happens when we apply potassium. Okay. So if we can, let me get this back up on screen here. Okay, here we go. The title of the paper that you published in 2006 is Potassium Availability Indices in Turfgrass Performance in a Calcareous Sand Putting Green. Now, generally, when I'm by myself, Micah, I just read some particular parts of the introduction that I find interesting and work my way through it. But with the author here, would you mind just sort of setting the stage, just the introduction of what you did and why this question was being asked? What were the objectives of this study? And sort of just walk us through the introduction part of the paper. Would you mind?
Yeah, let me just say a few things.
Okay.
And then maybe turn it back over to you to guide us through.
Okay.
Because it was something that I was so excited to do, because I was coming from being a golf course superintendent who had been applying basically twice as much potassium as nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Because I had the idea that potassium was going to make the grass stronger.
Mm.
Because what I learned as an undergrad didn't teach me that. They didn't teach me that that was correct, but they didn't hammer that into my mind either, that like, that's a common trick to fall for. That's a common mistake to make, of thinking that adding more potassium is going to improve drought tolerance. Adding more potassium is going to improve disease tolerance. Adding more potassium is going to improve drought tolerance. They didn't tell me to like, that's not true. That's just don't make that mistake. And so then I read the fertilizer marketing material, and you see what other superintendents are doing. You see what, you know, I was a kid, right? So I'm doing what the older, experienced superintendents are doing, mm-hmm. and that's adding more product. And so my favorite fertilizer was potassium nitrate, mm-hmm. because it was a really good cost on that, I thought. Mm-hmm. And it had three times as much potassium as it did nitrogen. So yeah. I would just like use that all the time. So I was kind of going into the study thinking, yeah, I've been doing this, but is that correct? Right.
Yeah.
But I was kind of expecting that we'd see something from potassium. And okay. so I was so excited to like, I knew nothing when I was starting, which I think is typical when you kind of get into these kind of studies, right? Mm-hmm. So one thing was to like test that, but I was expecting that we'd see some response from potassium. And then it was like, wait a second, this is a calcareous sand grain. And Frank Rossi, who was my major advisor, he had the idea, which a lot of people rightly said, don't do this. But he had the idea of take a soil sample, send one to Earthworks, have them test it at Logan Labs or whatever, get their recommendation, apply that program. Okay. Get another one, send it to the Cornell lab, get that recommendation, apply that program. So the treatments would all be designed by somebody else. And you'd be like testing this lab's recommendations versus that lab's recommendations. There's so many things that vary with that, so many things that can go wrong. It would just be, that would not be a good way to do an experiment, I think.
Okay.
And so we kind of got steered away from doing that. But as we were looking into what we would do, it was like, wait a second, this is a calcareous sand. We're not even sure like which extractant is going to be the best. So we started looking at a extractant comparison also.
Hmm.
And so basically this was something to test the effect of potassium and also to test how the different extractants worked.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So that's kind of how it got started.
Yeah. Well, I know you had, yeah, we're going to see different extractants in this study, but I was under perhaps the wrong assumption that the soil test extractant work was done prior to this in a different publication, maybe on your master's or something. I don't know, but it was published like in Soil Science or something.
Yeah. So we took like the first year's data, I think.
Okay.
And you know how it goes in university research, and professors need to get tenure and they need to get articles published. And they also, for graduate students to graduate from Cornell, you need to have a certain number of papers published.
So
my graduate committee said, you should write a paper just about the different extractants. So we wrote a paper for soil science that was just about comparing the extractants. But what you see in this crop science paper, we're also showing the results for a lot of different extractants.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Right. So the whole thing, actually my dissertation was really about comparing the extractants. That's that's what it turned into. Cause that was the most interesting part, because with potassium, we didn't get any response, but with the different extractants, there were all kinds of interesting things that we saw.
Yeah. And you actually concluded a very unusual, not unusual, but for the practitioner, the extractants really never used. You found that extractant was probably a little bit better in terms of its predictive ability than some of the more common extractants. And that's in the other paper, I think. And maybe if people are so inclined to understand all that stuff, then maybe we can go pursue that at a future time, I suppose. But I didn't connect the two, that paper was actually still part of your PhD. It was just a separate part of just the extractants. And then this is more the potassium and
turf. Yeah. This is more about like the what happened on that green on the 2-year study.
Okay.
However, if you look at the information presented in this paper, it's also showing the different extractants.
Yeah.
But this paper is not really like comparing them too much.
Yeah.
And that soil science paper that was published, I think in 2005, it took like the first three soil testing events or something and said, let's dive into, what's really the differences between these different extractants.
I'm getting a question quite more frequently than I ever have, maybe because I have more exposure here on social media. I don't know why, but I get this question about, I would say once a week now, where someone asks me on an email or text and says, hey, can you go over the different soil tests and why I would need to use one versus the other in whatever location or whatever soil or whatever. And I will eventually, but I'm getting that a lot, and I guess the average person doesn't necessarily delve down deep into the literature, and you know they just go by whatever their extension office recommends, which in your location is probably valid in most cases. But the point is, I guess where I'm going with this is that different soil test extractants are more appropriate on specific soils because they have a better ability to predict what will happen in the plant. For example, if you're going to be using something on let's say a pH of, I don't know, 8 or something, you might not want to use a very strong acid because the likelihood of being wrong is greater with a strong acid than an extractant that is more representative of what the plant can actually take up in that type of pH soil. So I don't know. It seems to me like it's a little bit more detailed than what I think the general audience would want to know. But I keep getting that question a lot. And the other paper we're not going to talk about it today, but the other paper sort of talks about, you know, the different extractants and why one was deemed to be more appropriate for potassium in these soils than others. And so maybe that's something we go into in the future. Who knows?
One we chose is not commercially available. So
yeah,
I have samples that I'm storing. I have samples that are accumulating at the lab across a certain pH range. Because the real benefit of the 100th molar strontium chloride extractant is that it adjusts to the pH of the soil, and it's also extracting at a similar ionic strength to what you have in a sand root zone. So for sand root zones, I think it's a very attractive extractant. And so I'm going to make one more go at this. And I've talked with Dr. Luke Baker at Brookside, and we're going to compare this against a couple other extractants and try one more time to see if this is something that might be commercially viable. but certainly my PhD research was quite promising with it.
Yeah.
But then it's not something that in 2006 we were able to really do in a lab. But now I'm thinking, maybe if people have questions about it now, and now I'm a little bit more well known, so maybe if I recommend it now, instead of this little kid that just graduated from graduate school, now yeah. it's somebody that maybe people would listen to,
yeah.
and maybe more people would be interested in doing that.
Well, you know, maybe we should pursue that in a future episode. But just real quick, the elevator speech. How did you actually come across the strontium option as a soil test to extract and to explore?
There was the lady that ran the testing lab in the ICP in the horticulture department. I don't remember her name, but she was very smart. Mm. And also Dr. Murray McBride, who was my soil chemistry teacher at Cornell. And you know, he wrote a book on soil chemistry. Mm. Between the two of them, I told them what I wanted to check in an extractant. And I said, turfgrass people really want to measure calcium. People in turfgrass, that they're accustomed to getting a calcium result on the soil test, and whether that's useful or not, they're accustomed to seeing it, and they would tend to want to see it. Mm. And we all knew that the 100th molar calcium chloride would be a really nice extractant. But if you've got calcium in the extractant, you can't measure accurately how much calcium has been extracted from the soil. Yeah. And those two people told me that we could basically, strontium is very similar chemically in the way it's going to exchange with other elements. And that's why radioactive strontium is so hazardous, because it can substitute for calcium in your body, in your bones, and so you can end up with a lot of radioactive strontium. But strontium is not always radioactive, but there are isotopes of strontium that are radioactive, and so that is something that is hazardous, because your body could mistake strontium for calcium. And as a soil test, if we just substitute strontium chloride for calcium chloride, we can basically get the exact same results, which is why you'll see in my study, I was doing calcium chloride and strontium chloride extractants.
Okay.
And they were measuring exactly the same amount of potassium.
Okay. Thanks for that clarity. Cause I was curious. I was like, how did you even come across that extractant? I've never even heard of it, you know, and then it comes.
I think there'd been like one or two other people that had done it, but basically we're just taking the well-known method of 100th molar calcium chloride, which you can measure pH in it. You can measure dissolved organic carbon, all kinds of things that you can't measure in Mehlich 3. You can't measure in one normal ammonium acetate that's buffered at pH 7. There's a lot of things that those extractants that you can't measure it, where a 100th molar calcium chloride would be a universal extractant, except you can't measure calcium in it, but you do strontium chloride. Now we can measure everything that we're interested in, and it's going to adjust to the pH of the soil. And we know that it's extracting at an ionic strength that is very similar to the pH of the soil, which is very important when I'm especially interested in sand root zones, and because that's what tends to be used for golf course putting greens, for sports fields, for a lot of high maintenance turf. And in sand root zones, the cation exchange capacity and a lot of the nutrient storage is on organic matter. It's on the soil organic matter exchange sites. Mm-hmm. And those are pH dependent charge, and they're affected by the ionic strength of the solution. So it's like when you're trying to estimate CEC of a sand root zone and doing that with Mehlich 3 and summing the extractable cations, you get twice as many nutrients as you do if you use strontium chloride. And if we actually measure, there's a chapter in my dissertation that is not published, but it's the most interesting part of my PhD research. It's in my dissertation. It's about estimating cation exchange capacity of sand root zones.
Okay.
If you use a really accurate method like the barium chloride compulsive exchange method, which is what we did, we end up with something that matches the strontium chloride magnitude of CEC, and Mehlich 3 overestimates it by 200%.
Okay. I didn't know that. That's very interesting. We should definitely get into that.
So we're getting a long ways away from what we're supposed to be talking about here.
Okay. Well, let's get, I was just curious because I don't know, that's just for my own nerdy interest, I suppose. So, but it's good information. I'm glad you mentioned that. Well, let's do get into the little bit more of the details of this study. So that was the introduction. I mean, you gave a really good explanation as to why you were interested in doing this and how you got to that point. And then we go into the materials and methods. You want to just go over the details of the materials and methods, or you again want to prefer to just kind of give us a once over as to what you did and where you did it and all these things?
Yeah, I read this yesterday, and I think it made sense to me when I read it yesterday. Okay. I don't really know how to highlight anything in the materials and methods. I mean,
okay.
we added potassium at five different rates, and then we had one plot that had no potassium, mm-hmm. and we did that starting in the spring of 2002, and we continued it until 2004, and then we tested the leaf tissue every month, and we tested the soil every 56 days, I think?
It was, I can't remember, but something around that number. Yeah, it was.
And the potassium source was potassium sulfate. Mm-hmm. Everything was dissolved and sprayed as a liquid. And we put enough phosphorus to prevent phosphorus deficiency. And we were putting about 3 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet per year, a little bit more. Something like 150 kilograms, 170 kilograms of nitrogen mm-hmm. per hectare, which mm-hmm. seems high to me now for that climate, but it seemed reasonable to me at that time.
Yeah, well, on the climate issue is that this was done. This was conducted at Cornell. This is the 2-year study mm-hmm. on a L93 creeping bentgrass putting green at the Cornell University Landscape and Research
That's right.
Education Center. So this was in Ithaca, New York. And the short and skinny of it is that you were on L93 creeping bent grass, you had a variety of different rates of potassium. I think they ranged from about 0.2 and then you went up 0.2 pounds of N. I think that was every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks you applied either 0.2, 0.4, 0.6, 1 or 1.2 pounds of N per thousand. And then you had a no potassium at a zero in there as well. So you had a non-treated control. And just for those interested, this states that the root zone sand had an initial Mehlich 3 extractable K of 2.2 millimoles per kilogram, which is roughly around 80 parts per million. Does that sound about right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something around
yep.
that number.
Yeah, so I was using the rather unconventional units of millimoles per kilogram, and so 39 parts per million or 39 milligrams per kilogram would be equal to 1 millimole. Take 2.2 times 39, and that gives you your ppm equivalent.
Okay, so and that's give or take where this value is right here on this graph, this initial around mm-hmm. two, this initial point here. Mehlich 3. So most people are going to be familiar with parts per million Mehlich 3. There might be some Morgans and ammonium acetate people in the audience too as well. But just understand that you denoted, actually, I don't know if it was yourself or it was, I think you cited Bob's GCM article about the identification of what's high and low and medium. And I can't remember that paper exactly, but it's somewhere between 70 and 100 parts per million Mehlich 3. They denoted as medium amounts of potassium.
Yeah, they go up to 116 is medium.
Okay, 116.
So 117 is the low end of the high range for a sand root zone.
Low end. Okay. And so that's the setting we're dealing with. You're dealing with a sand putting green with bent grass that it was denoted back then as having medium or just in the low end of the high amount of potassium according to what was then the interpretation of that value. Even today, I would consider that to be very high. So it is what it is. But so on these graphs, one thing I wanted to ask or just make a comment on these graphs, well, I'm looking at the graphs on figure one where Dr. Woods applied these increasing rates of potassium from zero up to 1.2 pounds every 2 weeks. And on the x-axis, we have dates, and on the y-axis, we have potassium that was extracted by the extractant, so the concentration. And it's not quite as obvious in these graphs as it has been in some of the previous papers that I've gone over. But what I wanted to call the audience's attention to is this solid circle where there is no potassium applied. And in this Malik 3 graph, it's not quite as obvious here as it has been, but you'll notice that the potassium fluctuates in these sand-based putting greens over the months, over the seasons, even when no potassium is applied. And in general, not so clear in this paper, but in general, the lowest amount of potassium that's extracted tends to be in the springtime, usually in the April, May soil testing months, if you want to call it that. They tend to be lowest in that month, even when no potassium is applied.
I'm surprised by that. I think if you look
it depends
on the climate, but in places where it rains, you tend to have the lowest at the end of the growing season.
Mm.
So it tends to be lowest in autumn.
Mm.
And it's the same as what my research shows. This is for like places where there's winter, but you get some release of potassium in the, so the grass uses it all year.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lowest at the end of the year in autumn. And then the soil tends to release some. So it actually will be higher in the spring than it was in the autumn. That's what would be typical across the northern U.S. and Canada, I think.
I'll have to go back. I know, let me see here. What was the paper? Let me look at this again. The paper, there were two papers, and I'm not going to remember which paper it was, Mike. I can't remember if it was the beer paper. There was two papers in here that measured over months, and they showed great fluctuation. I know for sure it was the beer paper, but there's another one. I don't know if it's the Fitzpatrick and Gallard. I have to go back and look. That both showed changes in the months of potassium over time. There was definitely changes, as you are showing a little bit. It's not quite the fluctuation in your paper as it was in these other papers. In other words, the fluctuation here, it's just not as great. It tends to be more stable in your research than it has in the other research I've gone over. But generally, they'll show the increase going in the summer, and then it starts declining. And maybe it's just a matter of when they actually took the soil sample. But it starts declining in the fall, and then the lowest point on the other papers tended to be in the spring. But maybe that's just when they did a sampling. Maybe they didn't do a sample in November. I don't remember those papers. But regardless, yeah, the highest point was in the summertime, when it's hot and the grass is growing and they're applying potassium, and then it tends to decline.
Yeah, I mean, you can see in mine, it kind of tends to peak at the times where I'm applying it.
Yeah.
And then after rainfall events, and in fact, what that soil science paper was about was looking at like those first three dates.
Mm.
And so it starts, and then we added a lot, and then it either rained a lot in July or we were getting a lot of dry spots, and the irrigations, I think it was the irrigation got increased.
Okay.
And we leached a lot of it out. And so just we looked at those first three dates and looked at what we could tell from the different extraction methods.
Okay. Okay.
And you see like there's that dip in the winter.
Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to see exactly where the winter is. So it's May. It's hard for me to tell exactly. So this, which one are you referring to? The Malik 3 dip here? This here?
Yeah, look at the Malik 3.
When is this? Is this winter? I see May and then.
No, I mean, I think that's spring. I think the low there is.
Oh, you're talking about
the
this.
Spring of yeah. 2003.
Yeah, I think you're talking about this as it's declining. Over on, like,
I'm talking about the one that's in the middle. Oh. But yeah, I would make those charts differently if I was doing it today. but I'm not going to apologize for what I did at my best of my ability back then. No,
hey man, I have not yet read one paper that's flawless. I'm not, there's nothing wrong with this paper. I have more flaws in my paper than I don't even want to read my papers. They're so, you know, I got issues, but I'm not saying there's anything wrong. I'm just saying that I just want to point out that, that potassium from extractants varies over the seasons. That's the sort of the take home message, is that if you take a sample in the summertime compared to the spring or the autumn, just without applying any K at all, those values are going to fluctuate, especially if they're contained, the soils contain potassium bearing minerals that are mineralizing some of the potassium as the temperatures go up, greater than when the temperatures are lower. It's going to be a great deal of fluctuation. And the, I guess what I try to tell people is that it, I don't run into potassium deficiencies. I've never actually observed one personally. I've only read it in the literature and been on the locations where the research was conducted. So I'm not a big fan of, you know, applying potassium just because I just don't see much of a response in it. But if for some reason you're convinced, I guess the, well, I'm talking you, not you, doctor, but I mean, the audience is convinced that you have a potassium deficiency and you're going to try to diagnose that on a soil test, don't do it when the likelihood is going to be very good that the potassium is going to be at its greatest. In other words, do it at the time of year where the probability is good that the potassium in the soil is going to be at its lowest. Does that make sense? I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I always recommend testing when it's likely to be at its lowest. And if we look at three climates, I can recommend when that would be typically. So if you're in a temperate climate where you've got a winter where the grass doesn't grow, like New York, and it also rains there, then it's typically going to be lowest in autumn. So that would be my recommended time to sample. If you're in a place like California or Arizona or southern Spain or Italy or Greece, and you tend to get rain in the winter, and then it doesn't rain very much in the summer, at that time, you're going to tend to get the lowest values in the springtime. And then if you're in a more tropical place like Florida or Bangkok or Singapore, well, Singapore, it rains all year. But if you're in a place like Bangkok or Manila or Florida, where you do tend to have a rainier season, you'll have the lowest levels typically at the end of your rainy season. So those are three climates that cover a lot of the area around the world where turf grass is grown. And if you're in a place like Dubai and you're irrigating with poor quality water that has high salinity and naturally will have a lot of potassium in it, then you would want to test after a leaching event, I suppose. But so that pretty much covers everywhere, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the take-home message from my perspective is have a good reason for when you're sampling. If you, I don't think you're going to run into a potassium deficiency very frequently, but when you're dealing with thousands and thousands of golf courses, there's chances are you're going to have one or two that have deficiencies here and there. And if you're going to do it and you're going to base it on a soil test, just have a good reason. Don't, for when you're going to do it, running out and just sampling for the sake of sampling without understanding a little bit of the background as to what would be a good time to at least have the, you know, the likelihood of having very low potassium and base it on that. Just use some critical thinking skills, I guess what I'm saying, rather than just blindly go out and sample and not have a good reason for it as to when you're doing it. I don't know how you feel about
that. Yeah, I think it definitely makes sense to sample systematically and compare over time and compare like October to October to October.
Yeah.
If you do that, you can see how things are changing. You can say, you know what, the potassium is going down in my soil. Now, that doesn't mean you have a deficiency, but you can know that it's going down.
Yeah.
But if you test June and then October and it goes down, you don't know if it's a time effect or if it's really going down.
Agreed.
And so you're exactly right. Use some patience and some thought, and give some thought to the sampling procedure, the sampling timing, and make sure that you're doing it in a sensible way. So you can actually, you know, it costs money. It takes time to collect a sample. It costs money to get it tested. So make sure that you can use that information to make a good decision and not just throw your money away.
Yeah. And the idea behind this sampling at this specific time of year is that theoretically, if it's at its lowest, and the lowest is pick some number, you know, 80 parts per million make three or whatever, 90, 100, then the chances of you ever getting to a deficient level is pretty low if you sampled at the lowest point of the year. And even the lowest point of the year is well above any agreed upon critical limit. I mean, I don't know. I guess you could probably find some critical limit that's around that number, but not on turf grass.
You know, unless you send it to Penn, unless you send it to State College.
Oh, oh yeah. You mentioned that yesterday. You're saying something. Their interpretation is still quite high. Yeah.
Yeah. The last time I checked, they wanted like 190 on golf course putting greens.
Pounds or parts per million?
Parts per million.
190 parts per million Malik 3 on putting green? That's what they're...
Okay, maybe it's 180. Maybe I exaggerate it.
No, I don't know. I don't know it. I'm just... That's wildly high.
Yes, it's wild. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It was that way the last time I checked it.
Wow.
It might be updated now, but...
Do we need to get Max on the phone and see what's going on over there at Penn State?
Max... I think Max doesn't take credit for that.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying, maybe we need to have some help over there to kind of get that ball rolling. Who knows? I don't know, but that seems crazy.
I don't know, but yeah, that's an interesting one.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I don't know what Florida and Kentucky is, but I'm virtually 100% certain at Kentucky that it's not based on turf grass, because as far as I know, there's never been a turf grass calibration or correlation done on potassium in Kentucky, mainly because it is really hard to find a soil in Kentucky that is low enough in potassium, including sand-based putting greens. It's not easy. It's very difficult to find one low enough to actually perform a proper calibration and correlation on. It's not easy. Anyway, we're nerding out. Let me get back to the paper. So
anyway, yeah, because we couldn't do a proper calibration on this one either because we never saw a deficiency. So
yeah.
We went for 2 years. We applied more than 6 pounds of nitrogen, harvested the clippings, put enough irrigation sometimes to leach, had enough rain sometimes to leach, and that grass was as good or better than the grass that got the low rate of potassium, the medium rate of potassium, and the highest rates of potassium.
Well, in this paper,
there was never a deficiency.
Yeah, and in this paper... And I'm glad you guys did it. I suspect it might not have been an initial objective, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it was just, you know, coincidental and you happened to see it, so you started measuring. But in this paper, you talk about disease, and I'm going to get to that. Let's get to that, because that's been mentioned multiple times in multiple papers. And I don't know if the audience fully appreciates the potential for potassium to result in increased risk of diseases. So, but it's in this paper as well. So let's finish through the materials and methods. Basically, it is what you said, you know, what we talked about. You measured leaf nutrient content of essential plant nutrients. You measured them, I guess here it is, as monthly you did this. You did visual ratings on 1 to 9 with 6 as the acceptable quality. Soil samples were collected before the first fertilizer application on 9 subsequent occasions. So you guys did that. Then you did potassium extracted from a variety of different extractants is what you mentioned. Then I'm going to get, where was the one I missed? I missed one somewhere in, I guess I missed it up here. Oh, traffic. Traffic was applied 6 days per week. Now in this paper, you're not going to see a lot of traffic results. I think maybe that was just required because that's what was going on a separate component of the study or someone else's study.
No, we didn't. Everywhere got the same traffic.
Oh, okay.
The idea was just to simulate, just so that people couldn't criticize this and say, well, your results are not valid because it wasn't traffic.
Okay, fair enough.
So we put traffic across it.
Okay, so you weren't measuring different amounts of traffic or plus or minus
traffic.
We were
just trying to be realistic with the traffic.
Perfect, okay. And then you had disease damage from dollar spot and gray snow mold, which was measured visually as a percent of plot affected. You also did ball roll. There was a conclusion and some verbal discussion of the ball roll, I think briefly, but there wasn't any result, I think mainly because you didn't see anything happen. And then you did ash-free root weights. And so that's sort of like the setting. That's sort of just summation of kind of what you did. We're looking at roots. We're looking at ball roll. We did traffic damage to really be more representative of what you're going to actually encounter on a putting green in real life. Measured diseases, measured quality, measured leaf root, leaf content, soil extractions. a whole gamut of variables were measured in this study, which is why I like this
chlorophyll
study.
Yeah, we measured chlorophyll, so much stuff.
Okay, perfect. Now, if we can get to the results, I'm going to flip this thing on its side here in a second. Let's see. Let me just do that now. Let's see if I can get it on the screen here. So this can't see the y-axis here, but for the audience, the y-axis is tissue potassium and the x-axis is the potassium application rate. These sorts of graphs where we're looking at increasing amounts of potassium and its effect on tissue potassium is pretty consistent in the literature that when you apply more and more potassium, you're pretty consistently going to result in more and more potassium in the leaf tissue. Is that your position as well, doctor?
Yep. Yeah, that's not really a surprise. And we just wanted to document that. And advice to graduate students out there, don't do your regressions like I did of the means, because that inflates the R-squared value and makes it look better than it actually is. So if I would do that again, I should show all the data and instead of plotting the mean tissue content. So this makes it look a little bit cleaner, but it's not really the proper way to do it because those R squared values end up being inflated.
Yeah.
But I think I actually cited a Gomez and Gomez paper that said it was okay to do that, but I don't subscribe to that.
Yeah.
And I've talked with Bill Kreuzer about it because he did that in one paper, and I was like, man, don't do that. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. That it's like, we really have to be honest. And I hate to do any kind of statistics or present any data that makes things look better than they really are.
Yeah.
So what you really see if you'd plot those data is a lot more variation.
Yeah.
Up and down.
Yeah. You'd see like dots like this and dots like this.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that would be the way that I would do it now.
Yes.
And it may be okay to do that, but definitely those R squared values. I think the P values will be the same, but the R squared values get way inflated.
Yeah. Well, actually,
meaning it makes it look like it's more highly correlated than it really is.
Correct. Yes. And oftentimes I've actually done this both ways. And in I'm not a statistician, Micah. I fully acknowledge. I when I step out of my lane and move into stats, I have a statistician on speed dial, and I do exactly what he tells me to do because I'm not a statistician. But the strange thing is that sometimes I found the p-value to change. The R squared goes up, and so oftentimes the p-value goes down for some reason. And I don't know, but one way or the other, the graphs look nice and simple and clean when you do the mean. But it's not at all. Particularly representative of the amount of variation, what would really happen in the true R squared of the actual values, right? Mm-hmm. The R squared is going to go down, and sometimes the P value goes up, or sometimes it's strange how it works that way, but I'm in 100% agreement with you. And I wasn't going to say anything about that because I've made the same mistake. It is what it is. I think other researchers oftentimes, they make the same mistake, and at the end of the day, you know,
well, we've cautioned the next generation to avoid making the mistakes that we have.
Yeah, no, there's it's exactly. I've made that error as well. No problem. This is more this varies by tissue nitrogen, but you see all these dots everywhere. This is probably more raw data numbers here, I would think, right, Michael? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no means there.
Yeah, so that's tissue nitrogen and tissue potassium. And there is usually a positive relationship here. It's not a great R squared, but it's highly significant. And generally speaking, the higher the tissue nitrogen is, the higher potassium nitrogen is in general. You're not generally going to see it flat or negative. You're normally going to see a positive relationship there. I just wanted to read some of the yellows and the reds. When I highlight something in yellow and red, Mike, it just means kind of make sure that I don't forget to at least discuss it or ask you about it or read it because I find it particularly interesting. And so we're looking here at the soil K dynamics over time. And it says, we speculate that non-exchangeable potassium was increased in plots receiving the higher rates of potassium, and that this pool served to resupply potassium to exchangeable and soluble forms when solution potassium activity decreased after leaching. And then you go on and discuss this a little bit. But that topic has not gone away in the literature. It was discussed many decades ago.
I'm just going to take a break.
Okay.
And go use the toilet and be right back.
Okay, no problem.
If you'll excuse me, I've been pounding the coffees here to stay awake.
No problem. I'll go to me and I'll discuss this. No problem. So, as Dr. Woods goes and takes a little break, what I wanted to mention is that even in this paper that was conducted in New York on putting greens, they also speculate that the components of the root zone may have had some potassium bare minerals or non-exchangeable potassium in it that contributed to the uptake of potassium. So again, this is nothing new in the literature. I don't know if it's necessarily new to the audience or you're listening to this or not, but this is very, very common to find that we're applying potassium, we're measuring potassium coming back, and the numbers aren't always adding up. And we find out that there's something else in the system that we did not originally account for, and it's normally potassium-bearing minerals that are not accounted for in the soil test. So he also comments on that in this paper. The tissue potassium content. Let's see. Is he back? Let me see. Okay. The tissue potassium content. Mike, I was just mentioning that you mentioned non-exchangeable potassium, which is what many other researchers have also postulated as a potential explanation. And I don't know. Well, I don't have it on screen. I don't know necessarily what we need to do as scientists to, well, from my perspective, emphasize that contribution to the soil turf grass system when it comes to potassium, because the soil tests, as you find in this paper, as Beer found, and even as I think it was Gallard found or concluded, the soil tests for potassium are not particularly good at predicting what's going to happen in soils that have potassium bare minerals in them, because it's not accounting for that component. What do we need to do? I mean, what I'm really ultimately concerned about is people applying potassium, spending money when they don't need to, because a soil test might interpret it as low when in fact the turf grass won't be deficient because of potassium bearing minerals. Thoughts on that?
My thoughts on it, which I haven't fully implemented because I don't systematically collect the potassium application data from every site that I'm making a recommendation for. And I don't have the historical data, but for places where I'm doing soil testing every year, and they're places that I work with on a consultancy basis pretty closely, I'll know how much potassium they apply. And also I know what the potassium was on this date and then like 360 days or 370 days later. And I know how much potassium was applied in the interim. So we can do a mass balance based on how much, either based on how much the grass grew or based on how much nitrogen was applied. We can look at what the maximum potassium use for that species at that site should have been. And then we can see how the soil changed. And so what you find is there's either going to be some potassium missing, or you're going to find potassium there that you didn't expect to be there. And from that, you can get an index of how much that soil is supplying extra potassium. And that for me is the solution that just we haven't implemented, but we should have another section of a soil test report that looks at how much potassium did you apply since your last soil test? And then we look at how the soil potassium did change compared to how it should have changed. And from that, we can get a good idea. And it turns out that there's always more potassium floating around than there should be. And then it's like, okay, that's coming from somewhere.
That's basically what I've been saying the last two or three episodes. And that's what you all continue to talk about in the tissue K content in the next paragraph or the next section. It says, this supports the finding of Desk and Gallard and Colby and Bredakis in 1966, who suggested that the ability of bentgrass species to utilize potassium from non-exchangeable forms in the soil may diminish the value of standard soil tests in predicting or prediction of potassium availability to bentgrass roots. I mean, that's a little bit softer language, I think, than Dustin Gillard mentioned. They were very firm with their language. I was surprised to see such firm language in their paper, where they were like, these tests aren't really useful. And you're sort of hinting around that, you know, is that, you know, for potassium, I mean, I don't mean useful for everything. I mean, for potassium in soils that have potassium-bearing minerals, I mean, it's a little bit, I don't have a whole lot of confidence, I should say, because of stuff like this that we've seen consistent in the literature.
Well, yeah. And the Beer paper that I think you talked about, the Beer et al. Mm-hmm. paper that you talked about last week or yesterday or whenever, mm-hmm. That's a really good example of that, because yeah. they're down around 22 parts per million mm-hmm. or something, malic 3. It just doesn't go any lower. And it should go lower, but it doesn't go lower. Mm-hmm. And then they add more potassium and it doesn't go up as high as it should either. So it's clear the soil's not really storing it. Mm-hmm. And yet the soil doesn't lose it either. And you're like, yeah, the malic 3 wasn't really helpful for them in that case.
Exactly.
But, another thing we can do that's even simpler than what I described, because malic 3 tends to extract more, and if you look at that figure where I showed the relative amounts of the different extractants, you can see that malic 3 tended to extract the most. It's extracting a little bit more than ammonium acetate. It's extracting more than morgan, more than water, more than 100th molar strontium chloride. Mm-hmm. So it's getting some pool of the non-exchangeable K. Before MLSN, I was just really comfortable with 50, because mm-hmm. I felt like if we were getting 50 parts per million, which would be like 1.25 millimoles on that scale, mm-hmm. which was basically the bottom of that scale.
Yep.
I felt like, any soil, any sand that tests at 50 parts per million must have some amount of non-exchangeable K, and it's just going to be fine for the grass for quite a while.
I see.
And that was my recommendation before MLSN. And so when we did MLSN and we came up with the value of, I think the initial number was, well, now it's 37. It was either 35 or 39. It's 37 now. The 2 ppm difference is meaningless. I thought like 37, ooh, that seems low. Ooh, can we really go that low? Because I was using 50 before MLSN. And now I'm like, I'm so comfortable that 35 is fine, 30 is fine. And it's like, yeah, we can go even lower.
I agree. It's very possible to go lower. There's plenty of papers that show it can be lower. I think at some point, we're going to find the line where it's a soil turf grass issue, where it's going to might slightly differ, you know, here or there. But I've used this analogy before, is that we're going to keep walking and walking and walking closer to the cliff and closer to the cliff. And just like many nutrients, including potassium, when you get to that point where you will see a decline in turf quality, it's not gradual. It's usually very sharp. When you get to the critical limit and then you drop below it, you'll normally see a reduction quite rapidly, and then vice versa. When you add potassium, you'll see it increase quite rapidly. So the question is, where is that cliff? And then how comfortable is any individual turf manager getting close to that cliff? How comfortable are you with your risk of approaching where that cliff is? And I tell folks with my daughter, I've said this many times, I don't want my daughter anywhere near that cliff. I mean, I want her back away from that cliff, because the risk is much worse than any reward she would receive from getting close to it, to see over that cliff, to see the landscape, right? So it's going to be dependent, I think, upon the person's tolerance to risk, you know, but I think it's dependent upon us as scientists to continue to explore and find out where that cliff is, right? Because at 37 MLSN, as you mentioned, well, the cliff might be moved a little lower, or it might be a little high, you know, it might not be exactly that number, but you know, there is a cliff somewhere, right? And it's,
it's below that, because the MLSN minimum is not meant to be the cliff point. It's just meant to be a number that we use to make a reasonable fertilizer recommendation and to give some indication of where you are on the gradient of different elements, whether you're really close to low or whether you're relatively high. And I think it's really difficult to do this practically, which is why, you know, I would say that, and I have said in the past that we're never going to do proper soil test calibration for every possible grass and soil combination. And you know that the critical levels where that cliff edge would be are going to be different for different grass species and for different soil combinations. And because turf is a global crop, and because there's so many species, warm season, and it's not like just wheat or rice or maize that are one species with different varieties, but with turf grass, we've got different species, warm season, cool season, and then they're grown in so many different soils. So I despair of ever knowing exactly where that cliff is. And because I despair of ever knowing exactly where that cliff edge is, then I think for the turf grass manager who is a little bit interested in this and willing to be risk tolerant and willing to try to figure it out for their site, they can do that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I can do that for everywhere. I have no idea how to do that for Kikuyu grass and Bermuda grass and centipede grass and seashore paspalum and Zoysia mitrella and Zoysia tenuifolia and Kentucky bluegrass and all these grasses. And then on a sand root zone, on a clay root zone, on a silt loam, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm comfortable with something like MLSN that just works. And I know it's going to recommend a little bit too much, but it's safe. And I know that we're away from that cliff edge. And then if people on a site specific basis want to try to figure that out, or if somebody for a research project wants to do it, go for it. But I'm just kind of like, it's too big of a problem to solve.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I'd love to go into MLSN in great depth in the future for sure. That's a topic that when I get to soil testing, maybe we can explore further for sure. So,
maybe it should get published first, so it can qualify to be discussed on the channel.
There you go. So let's talk about turf grass performance, because this is where I like these grafts. I know you graft the means, and it is what it is. I'm not worried about that at all. The message is what I'm going to get across. The context is what I'm getting at here. And I do want to read a little bit of this yellow and red, because I think it's very important that the audience understands that this is yet another paper. And I've talked to my audience before, I don't base my confidence off of one paper. It helps. But when you see multiple papers over multiple turf grasses and multiple years have a similar conclusion, that's when my confidence begins to escalate greatly. And this paper adds to that. And you say here, that under the conditions with soil potassium levels as shown in figure 1 and tissue potassium content as shown in figure 3, the color ratings were not influenced by potassium addition. Now, I've mentioned this before. I've been doing this for a long time. I have never once seen a color response following the application of potassium from potassium. I can show you a photo right now, a color response to potassium sulfate. That's on a sulfate correlation and a sulfate calibration that I conducted. When you apply potassium chloride, you don't see anything. And it's just not common. But what is common to me is to hear on YouTube and in marketing this concept of potassium's the stress element, and you see great responses from potassium, and you got to really apply. We just don't see it consistently in the literature at all. I mean, I'll show you one or two papers in the next week where clearly there's a response. But generally, it's not. You're not going to see a response to potassium.
Generally. It's not just you don't see it in the literature. You don't see it.
Yeah, you don't see it.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. So let's go down to the red, and because then I'm going to talk about this graph. I don't want to overlook this graph. The Oh, well, ball roll for those golf course superintendents, obviously, is on a putting green. It says the ball roll on six measurements dates from on six measurement dates was affected by the date that it was taken, but not by the potassium application. So potassium did not affect ball roll. In another study, they actually concluded that application of potassium reduced ball roll. In this case, there was no benefit to applied potassium on ball roll. Okay. There were also no effects of potassium application, soil potassium concentration, or leaf tissue potassium content on clipping yield. So there was no effect in this study. They weren't able to measure any response in those variables. And then we get to the diseases. Dollar spot infection was not affected by potassium application, which is a good thing. However, gray snow mold damage observed in the spring of 03 and 04 was increased in plots receiving higher rates of potassium. There was also more rapid spring growth in 2003 in plots which received no potassium the previous year. I mean, sometimes, who was that fitness guru who said, we got to stop the madness? I can't remember who she was. But this is at least the third paper where there was a reduction in spring growth or reduction in spring greening when potassium was applied. There was greater greening when no potassium was applied. This is the third or fourth paper that has concluded or found that there was an increase in disease risk. In this case, I think it was gray snow mold. Other times it's been pink snow mold. And there was one case on warm season grasses where it was dollar spot. What do we got to do, Micah? What do we need to do in order to find a way to get turf managers to apply potassium in a more evidence-based manner to reduce the risk of increasing the risk of diseases and actually do it when the turf actually needs the potassium? We would see a benefit. What do we got to do? I don't know what we got to do. The evidence is staring us in the face right here, and yet people continue to overapply it.
Yeah, I'm kind of optimistic because there's more and more people, I think, that are coming around to this way of fertilizing. Certainly within the golf industry, I've been contacted by more and more people year after year. So I'm as busy as I ever have been in terms of people contacting me, asking for advice about interpreting soil tests or making fertilizer plans. And I feel like it really takes a generational change because people that have been successful in their careers, they're going to be risk averse. They're not so keen to change what they believe in and what they think works. But you've probably heard the phrase that science advances one funeral at a time. And I don't mean that that we wish ill on anyone, but what that means is there's powerful and influential people that younger people don't really feel they're able to question, or they're not able to use their ideas because they have to follow what the senior people or the more well-respected legends in the industry have done. And so that works in science. That also works in golf course maintenance and probably in lawn care or sports field maintenance. And I think that as we have a younger generation, I'm middle-aged now, as we have a younger generation of people that they hear this kind of stuff. This is what you're saying is very logical. What I'm saying, I think it's, to me, it seems quite logical. Mm-hmm. And we can just say, okay, your default amount of, let's just forget soil testing just to guarantee that you don't ever have deficiencies. We never want deficiencies. Just apply what the grass uses. And what the grass uses is going to be about 33-40%. The potassium will tend to be 33-40% of the nitrogen. It depends on the species, but it's something like that. Mm-hmm. With Seashore paspalum, it's a little bit higher. With bent grass and Bermuda grass, you're in the 30-40% range generally. And so we can say, you know what, your default amount to apply can just be that. And if you really like to apply it, that's fine. That would be such an improvement on where we are right now. But then we can say, wait a second, if your soil can supply potassium, you can actually apply even less. And I think this is a very logical approach. Mm-hmm. And I just think we just keep preaching that. Mm-hmm. We keep explaining that. And I feel that it can't help but be adopted by the leaders of the industry into the future. And so I kind of despair of changing the people who already are in the very successful, important roles, but that their replacements, I think, are mm-hmm. going to change it. So as we look 10, 20 years down the road, mm-hmm. I think people might say that I was actually recommending too much and they okay. actually, you know, so things will change. Yeah. And then after my funeral, people can, you know, do even better than what I've done. Yeah. But as you get into a kind of an influential role, it's too easy just to tell people, oh, my idea is so good, just I'm right. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to question as much. They can't because yeah. of that power relationship or the influence that people have or the respect that they have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't remember the name of it. Whoops. Sorry. I hit the wrong button. I can't remember the name of it, but there is a psychological name for the condition that you described that identifies the progression in our society. And in this case, we're talking about progression in turfgrass science is retarded until the previous generation retires and moves on. In other words, we're hindered by the restrictions put forth on the generation that exists controlling the information, basically. Once they retire or they move on, then the next generation can come forward and move the science forward. And we see that plateau change, and then it goes to the next plateau. There is actually a scientific or a psychological term for that, and I can't remember what it's called, but I agree with that argument. I've experienced that argument, and on my end, being the younger generation and trying to compel the older generation that's in power to adopt different perspectives, and it's not easy, very difficult, very difficult. And maybe just make an additional point on your 30-40% potassium relative to nitrogen. I'm going to go over one more paper at least that will do nothing but agree with that statement, where the uptake of potassium and the need to apply potassium is relative to nitrogen, and it's usually about half or a little bit less than half of the nitrogen that was applied. Any benefit you're going to receive from potassium, which I doubt you would receive much at all, but if you're going to receive it, you're going to receive it from that amount of potassium relative to nitrogen, which corresponds with what you just said, Dr. Woods, when 30-40%.
And I'll just say one more thing about that disease stuff too. If you see the pictures of those plots, in those springs, if you see the pictures, they're a lot more powerful even than those statistics.
I'm glad you said that, because just coincidentally yesterday I happened to have Soldat's slides up. I didn't have it on. I didn't do that on purpose. I was showing the data, and I happened to have the slides on PowerPoint already queued up, and I showed the pictures, and he had 30-40% disease infection. I was like, that is severe, 30-40%. And on this paper, in April 2023, you're going from 15 from no potassium up to about 40% of the plot area affected when the highest rate of potassium was applied. Even at, let's say, 50% here, I don't know what that number actually is, that is a severely affected plot at 50%. Mm-hmm. Some of these are 60, 70, 80. So for the person who's not used to seeing these plots, I agree with you, Dr. Woods, is that this is severe disease outbreak when you get up into 30s and 40s, and you're greater than that.
I've got a couple blog posts that show that.
Okay.
That have pictures on the AsianTurfGrass.com website.
Okay.
It's shocking how bad it was. And then Dave Moody did research on Poa annua, and he also found that there was more rapid disease growth when higher rates of potassium were applied. Yeah. And then Doug's been doing his study and finding on bentgrass that there they have more disease the mm-hmm. more potassium they put. And it's been this, and it's so repeatable year after year after year, they can get that same result. And we just stumbled across that because I just noticed it when the snow melted.
Yeah.
And so
this was
then we saw it happen again the next year.
Okay. So this wasn't, was I correct? I guess the question is, was I correct when you started it? This wasn't necessarily the intended objective, but it happened measuring.
We tried to put as little fungicide as possible so that we could see if there were any disease issues that we detected.
Perfect.
But we didn't set out to do a plant pathology type of study. And so this was just like we happened to observe this.
Great. So whether it's in 2003 in March or April or March or April the following year, very consistently, the zero amount of potassium applied resulted in the least amount of gray snow mold year after year after year. And the more and more you applied, very linearly, very, very consistent increase the more you applied. And that's what we found in many other publications. Okay, let's get to the conclusions and we'll wrap this thing up. We were not able to detect any effects of potassium application on turf grass performance parameters such as ball roll or visual quality. I love these conclusions. I'm never quite so bold, but I love people who have the courage to say something. That just, that's what you found, and we didn't see any benefit. The stability.
I was pleased when I reread it, and I was like, for writing that when I was a graduate student, I was pleased with how the introduction just kind of got right to it, and then how I just explained what we did. And made clear conclusions that weren't too speculative, but they weren't too beating around the bush. I thought.
Yeah. Well, you can say that. I mean, I don't want to be too pedantic here, but when you're saying we're not able to detect, you're not saying it caused no effect. You're just saying we weren't able to detect it. We were not able to actually measure this and detect it. So you didn't say it didn't do it. You didn't say, so that's the way you're supposed to say it. Very, very well worded. The stability of extractable soil K, even when no potassium was applied, suggests that release of potassium from non-exchangeable forms in the root zone was sufficient to meet plant requirements at this site. Now, you have to understand, this is coming from a scientist who acknowledges at the beginning, he was excited. He was thinking he was going to see a bunch of responses to potassium. And you're like, we didn't see anything. And it's probably coming from non-exchangeable forms of potassium. So this is, sometimes I run across this in some of my emails and some of the comments I get on the channel. It's like, well, some of the more ornery people, like, well, you guys were looking for this response and you published what you found. Well, in this case, that doesn't happen that frequently, but in this case, he was looking for he was expecting a positive response and he didn't see it. And he just, you report.
That's why we chose such really, really high rates, because I was expecting that we were trying to bracket the level. I thought we'd have some rates that were too low, some rates that were too high, which is why we chose so many rates and we went so high, because I thought we're going to get that whether it's a 1-to-1 ratio or a 1-to-2 ratio or whatever, N to K, I thought that's where we'd see a response. And so we had to go beyond that so that we had where we expected to see the response in the middle. And instead, there was nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, it's very consistent.
So all those rates were kind of useless in the end. We could have just gone with like three rates.
Yeah, well, I mean, hindsight, I'm doing some sulfur work and you hope when you create a range, you hope that the range that you're trying to target is somewhere in the middle. You hope. But when you don't really know, you got to pick a low and you got to pick a high, and you do use your best judgment and pick them, and you move forward and maybe you determine later that we didn't need that. But that's research, and sometimes we get lucky and sometimes we do two or three rates we didn't need to, and it is what it is. And the last sentence, the current target ranges of extractable K in sand root zones promote K fertilization applications that may be detrimental to turf grass performance. And I don't know what else I have to do other than show people the literature that I'm going to show it where there's potassium applications result in reduced risk of some diseases in some situations. and the reduced risk of winter kill in some situations. I haven't got there yet. I'm going to get there at the end of this week or next week. But there is very clearly a case to be made to, and in my opinion, to eliminate potassium applications and then opt in to potassium applications when you have a good reason to do it. Otherwise, you're going to end up being the king, the mouse, and the cheese, where you're applying potassium because you think you have a potassium deficiency, and then you have a disease pop up. Then you apply a fungicide to kill the disease that popped up as a result of applying potassium. And you just end up on this hamster wheel cycle of constant use of resources, when in reality, it was the application that you didn't need to make, probably, that started the hamster wheel turning. And I guess that's my concern when with stuff like this, Micah.
Well, yeah, we can keep sharing the good information and people can take advantage of it. Yeah.
I wonder if I put a poll up on maybe I'll do that on the community tab. How many people before listening to this last 2 or 3 weeks of potassium realized that there could be an increase in disease as a result of applying potassium before they were exposed to this information? I wonder if they realized it was possible. I bet the number would be, you know, a little surprising, because I think most people go about their day thinking it's either going to be beneficial or maybe we don't see anything. I don't know if many people actually think you could harm it. The turf could be harmed. Mike, is there anything else you want to mention before we close out today?
No, it's been good talking with you, but it's pretty late here.
Okay. So you're tired. You had a long day. Well, I'll close it out. I'll just say thank you to Dr. Woods. Thank you very much for being here. It was a nice conversation. I really enjoy the when I have authors on that provide the insight behind the scenes sort of information from the studies they did. It provides more of a context in a setting for my own interest, I suppose. So I appreciate that. For everybody else, all right, I'll be. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. For everybody else, I'll be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. And as long as my voice holds out, I'll be here at 10 a.m. If something changes, I'll post it on the community tab if I can't speak. And for Dr. Woods, thank you. Just hang on real tight, Dr. Woods. I'm going to close this thing out and I'll be right back to you. For everybody else, thank you for attending. Thank you for your participation in chat. And we will see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. Bye. Thank you, Dr. Woods.